Thank you for this gift of a book.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the sentiment. And it was a journey to write it. I'm glad it's over. And I'm glad it's being well received.
Yeah, I must say, when I went to your reading at Auntie's, I was pleasantly surprised at how many people packed that room to hear your presentation of it. So you, in your prologue, we meet you 10 years ago, where you are in Four Lakes at the end of an asphalt road, looking up at a 10-foot-high granite monument that contains some factual errors. But you're there, as I recall, to answer two questions.
I stop at a lot of historical monuments on our drives. My wife will tell you, too many. But on this one, I'd never pulled off. I'd seen the sign saying Heritage Marker, I think, in the town, and went over and read the inscription, and it said that in September of 1858, Colonel Wright had led a force of men, soldiers, against 5,000 Allied Indians, and I thought, I think it said 700 soldiers. And I thought, how could 700 soldiers beat 5,000 Indians? And then also the memorial says on it that George Wright brought everlasting peace to the region. And I thought, well, I wonder what the Indians think about that.
Because it's a peace memorial.
Yeah, right, it's a peace memorial. And for who? Well, it's obvious for who. So those were a couple of things. One of them was kind of a military thing, like how can a small force like that beat such a huge force? And then what are the echoes? You know, what has happened since? And that started my years of starting to dig into books and archives and ask questions and answer them to the best of my ability.
So what were the questions that you brought to that moment in terms of yourself as a white male? Obviously, you know, all of us who are Anglo are imports here.
I mean, right.
What were the questions that you had about our history in the Northwest as defined by this conflict?
One of the overriding questions that I have, and I have then, and I still have, is do I have a duty as the descendant of the people who forcibly settled or settled this area? Do I have a duty today to help educate the population in a respectful way so that I don't bash, you know, people who were doing the best they could at the time, some of them were just outright cruel and so on. But do I have a duty today to kind of right the record? And that was a driving force behind this, and that is, I think, the driving question for me. People talk about white guilt. I don't really like that term. Indians don't like. Some Indians or some Native Americans do not like to hear white people talk about white guilt or say that they're ashamed or things like that, because, as Albert Andrews told me, he's an elder on the Colville, with the Colville Confederated Tribes, told me that we should just walk through history, but look to the future. You know, walk through history together. Don't stop and blame people or point fingers, but look and see what happened.
And you shared that, and I thought, what a kind thing to say.
Very kind.
But yeah. I think you would agree it doesn't absolve us of the weight of that question.
It doesn't.
And I sort of sensed as I read that was the third question that you had on your mind that day.
Yeah, it is. It was. And actually, I've been asking myself that question since I was in high school, when I had an enlightened history teacher, Mr. Green, who we were doing Washington State history, and I expressed some interest in relations with the Indian tribes, and he referred me to a book about Wounded Knee, and he said, you know, this isn't in the curriculum, but if you're really interested and you want to know what really happened, read this. And that started, that planted a seed that I think germinated 10 years ago when I saw
this. A wonderful phrase, isn't in the curriculum. Well, let's come back to that, but first let's do the history. As much for those who haven't read the book as who have, I mean, I'm in the Panama Canal Zone, and I'm being taught Lewis and Clark. and Sacagawea, and how this expedition of civilization, you know, of going into a land that had not yet been trammeled by Anglos. I mean, this core of discovery. And it's presented as a fairly benign story. I mean, and even acknowledging that, for example, the Nez Perce were responsible for getting that expedition, keeping that expedition alive, basically, in that first winter.
Yes.
Can you take us from there, from Lewis and Clark, up into episodes like, I mean, the nearest one that comes to mind is the Whitman Massacre. But when did in terms of the politics and the conflict that you write about in the book, when do they really get engaged in this historical timeline?
In 1850, Washington and Oregon and Idaho were all Oregon Territory, and in 1850, the Oregon Legislature passed the Donation Land Act, which gave free land to whites. And that's really when pressure started to ramp up on the Indian tribes. And as people, as the flow of people westward accelerated, of course, there started to be increasing pressure on the tribes along the travel routes, which were the rivers, which was in our region, the Snake and the Columbia were the primary routes of travel. And as the flow of people increased, the spread of disease increased, and there were some incidents of violence, although not as widespread as I think in popular media maybe as portrayed in the past.
Clearly one of the things that happens along this course, you know, that really gets the pot boiling is Governor Stevens and his arrival, I believe, in 1853.
Yes.
What was his task and what was his mission when he arrived here?
Stevens was quite an effective self-promoter. He was extremely intelligent, and he was very motivated for advancement politically. And he came out here to survey a route for the northern route for the railroad. And at the same time, in 1853, he was appointed governor of Washington Territory. And he appointed himself as the Commissioner of Indian Affairs for the territory, which raised all kinds of conflicts of interest. Mm-hmm. So we wore three different hats.
And this was a presidential appointment.
Presidential appointment, yeah.
President Pierce,
right. And he was very aggressive in his dealings with the tribes. He began to hold treaty councils around what is now present-day Washington State and into western Montana, holding treaty councils with the tribes and in at least a few cases, if not more, kind of browbeating them into submission to get signatures, and at least in a few cases, like Medicine Creek on the west side of Washington, you know, somebody in his party resorted to forgery to forge the signatures of chiefs on the treaty. And the Indian communication network was very effective, and any kind of an act in western Washington Territory or Oregon Territory would soon be known, literally within a matter of a couple of days, on the eastern portion of the territory, because Indians were traveling all the time, back and forth, trading, fishing, gambling, playing games, arranging horse racing events. It was a very active community in the Northwest. So what Stevens was doing was no secret to anybody. And for the purposes of the Columbia Plateau War, the big event was the 1855 Treaty Council at Walla Walla that he held, in which he tried to get the Yakimas, the Nez Perce, the Walla Wallas, the Palouse, and some of the Columbia River tribes to cede land to the government in exchange for reservations.
And this was a barnstorming year for him.
It was,
1855.
Yeah.
I mean, just in terms of the number of tribes that he was talking to.
He was, and it was an awkward thing for him because there were a lot of chiefs, and one tribe, like the Nez Perce, had any number of chiefs. There may be, I mean, a chief wasn't a formal appointment. It was somebody who was recognized by a certain group of followers or a family as being a chief. So the Nez Perce may have had 10 chiefs by one person's observation or 100 chiefs by another person's observation. So there wasn't, it wasn't like the tribes were an integral unit that with clear distinction from other people. A lot of times they were just separate families or family bands.
And, you know, from Stephen's point of view, as you disclose, I mean, it's easier to want to infer that if you can get one to be cooperative with you, discuss with you, express interest in signing a treaty, that that's the voice that you listen to, and want to hope that that person speaks for as many tribal members as possible.
And he decided that Kamayakan of the Yakamas would be the key figure in this treaty council, and Kamayakan didn't want any part of it. He was there, but he was very reserved. He wouldn't be. He observed from the back lines, I guess. And Stevens insisted that Kamayakan was speaking for the Yakamas, the Klickitats, a lot of the Sahaptan speaking tribes, and Kamayakan finally just kind of went along and says, whatever. And that was the attitude of a lot of the Indian chiefs who were there. They ended up telling Stevens what he wanted to hear, having no intention of fulfilling any of the provisions in the treaty, because they felt they were unjust, and they knew that, well, they were tired of being harangued by Stevens, because he would talk for hours on end telling them that they were children and they needed to do what he said, and he would take care of them, and blah, blah, blah. And tension started to rise, especially with some of the Cayuse and some of the Nez Perce, and people were getting pretty grouchy. This was a long treaty council, delayed by rainy weather and all kinds of things.
And the basic idea was to get them out of the way of railroads and to get them out of the way of white settlement.
Right.
And confine to areas where they would have perpetual rights, conceivably, and money.
Yes. And he was partially successful from the standpoint that later on, the lands that he had designated would end up being, at least in the beginning, lands on which the Indians would be forced to move. So he did define some territory, for better or worse. But he really planted some seeds, or put it a different way, he fanned some burning embers among the tribes. You know, it just made them mad. And again, that communication network went into high gear, and they said, you know, Stevens is on this rampage of trying to force people into treaties, and he was viewed with great skepticism.
Yeah. In your report, there was one for our area, and really the broader region eventually, one very important meeting that he had on the Spokane River, I believe in July of 1955, where Father Josette, the Catholic missionary, was present. He was unable to get, as I recall, the Spokanes and the Coeur d'Alenes to sign a treaty. And they were very concerned about him, about any troop movement north of the Snake River and into the area between the Snake and the Spokane, correct?
Yeah.
And so some markers started to be set down there that would have importance as this unfolded.
Yeah.
Do you want to pick it up from there?
Chief Gary at that meeting said that the land north of the Snake River is our garden.
Our garden.
We don't want the army or the settlers and, you know, coming into our garden. That's where we live and where we harvest food and fish for salmon and so on. And the Spokanes and the Coeur d'Alenes didn't trust the army or the government. They didn't trust Stevens, but on the other hand, with the help of Father Josette, they knew the importance of trying to get along. And so they were, in general, not antagonistic or confrontational. They listened, but they didn't agree. And they said to Stevens, we'll consider what you're saying. And Gary, Chief Gary of the Spokanes, had been raised at a white boarding school in Canada. He spoke English. Sometimes he wore Euro-American clothes. Sometimes he wore Indian dress. He straddled these two worlds, and sometimes that was really hard on him. And he was criticized for that by both whites and Indians at various times. But he really tried hard to keep peace. And the session with Stevens that you refer to was a situation where he really just tried to straddle a line and stand up for his people without antagonizing Stevens, which is a really hard thing to do.
Yeah. So in the same time frame, George Wright enters the stage. He's got his own unit that trains in Virginia, and makes a passage through the Panama Canal and comes up to Fort Vancouver, I believe, landing in
January of 1856.
Early in 1856, right?
Yeah.
And then I believe it is in March that we have the battle and the massacre at Cascade Rapids, and then that becomes his first meaningful foray into this conflict. I want to talk about
sure.
that and what happened there. And
so the Fort Vancouver had been there for a long time. In fact, in the very early 1800s, the Hudson's Bay Company had established a post there. And there were Indians that lived there next to the trading post. And once the Army post was established, they continued to live there. And some of them worked for the Army or for the Hudson's Bay Company. And it was kind of this bustling place. So Wright came in 1856 with his new 9th Infantry, and he was ordered to set up a post at the Dalles. And that was because that was kind of the entree to Eastern Oregon Territory, Eastern Washington Territory later on. And there is a point where the Columbia is squeezed into a narrow channel. Today it's where Cascade Locks is, uh-huh. and Stevenson on the Washington side.
Right.
And even today, when you go there, even with the dams and the water that's pushed up, you can see how the river changes in this dark stretch. It's kind of cool. And that was viewed as a strategic point both by the whites and by the Native Americans. There was a blockhouse set up. There was a lower landing, an upper landing, and in the middle there was a blockhouse built to protect the place.
This is Fort Raines.
Fort Raines. And then the north landing, they had the Bradford brothers set up a store and a little hotel boarding house thing. Mm-hmm. A few other businesses, and immigrants would come down the river, and you couldn't go by boat through the Cascade Rapids, so you'd have to get off and take this short railway from the upper landing to the lower landing, and there you'd get on a steamboat down to Fort Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And it was a real tough portage, but that's the only way down. So anyway, it was a choke point, and the Indians, the Kamiakan, actually decided that would be a great place for an attack, because if you could close that off, then the flow of materials eastward for the Army couldn't happen. So one March morning, some of the workers at the lower landing actually heard explosions and didn't realize what it was at first. They thought there was some blasting going on, and they were warned that there was an attack underway. So a group of Klickitats and Yakimas and some others had attacked the settlement at the upper landing, and then also the middle blockhouse. And a fight that went on for about 2 days, and there's kind of amazing stories that came out of it.
It's very gnarly, and it is. One of the tragedies is a Native American family was massacred as a case of mistaken identity, but also some sign of some pretty hot-headed behavior and retribution.
Yeah, there were. It was usually the incidents referred to as the Cascades Massacre, because there were, I forgot the number actually, 20 or so, 18 or so white people killed most of them civilians, nearly all of them. And George Wright and Colonel Steptoe were called to the rescue, and Phil Sheridan, who was Wright's subordinate down for him at Vancouver, came upriver on a boat, got there first, and kind of engaged in this clever military tactic to sneak up on the Indians and neutralize them. And then Steptoe arrived next and chased away the rest of them. They took some prisoners. And Wright arrived last, and they had, you know, trials and quotes. And hung nine of them. It was trial by finger and gun barrel. Sheridan put his finger in the gun barrel, rifle barrels of some of them, and came out with soot on it and said, oh, this has been fired recently. Mm-hmm. So they were hanged. And that incident really upset Wright's superiors, General Wool at the time, and also the rest of the chain of command of the Army, and so he told him to accelerate his building Fort Dalles, and also to make plans to go up into the Yakima Valley and establish more of a presence from the Dalles.
And also, as you report, opened up a very important rift from a historical perspective between Wool and Stevens, in which Wright was somewhere in the middle. Wool thought that Governor Stevens and the then governor of the Oregon Territory were actually trying to incite violence against Native Americans and incite a conflict for the benefit of white suppliers to the Army for profit motives.
Yeah, there is an implication to that.
To me, it was a remarkable thing for a U.S. general to say at the time.
I think there's some indications that might have been true. Stevens was a creature of the business community and a creature of the political system, and Wool was a product of the Army, a professional Army. He didn't go to West Point, but he certainly bore himself with a dignity that Stevens did not.
Much older than Stevens.
Much older, yeah. Yeah, he fought in the War of 1812. Yeah, he was, and he had in the Civil War, he was the oldest general on either side to have a battle command. I mean, he was an old man, he was 75 when he was given a battle command, Civil War. Mm-hmm. So he had this long, distinguished history, and Stevens was this diminutive Napoleon, as one person called him, who, by several accounts, was a drunkard and was very smart and very aggressive. Pissed off just about everybody around him. Even declared martial law in Washington Territory at one point.
Right.
And was sanctioned by Congress for that.
And Wool regarded him with contempt, basically.
Absolute contempt. And called him, in one letter, called him crazy. Doesn't know what he's doing. He told George Wright to stay away from him. In addition, Wool just detested the actions of white settlers and the militia. And the militia was Stevens' army. They were volunteers, and they were ruthless, they were undisciplined, and Stevens could make them do whatever he wanted them to do. Mm-hmm. And
but there were, the militias were also from Oregon Territory as well.
Yes, yeah, every territory had a militia.
And they were also...
Same.
And then always out in front of the Army and often arriving and inserting themselves into... dicey situations in ways that Wool just abhorred because he thought they were provocative and he thought that was purposeful.
Yeah. I read one account, a diary of a militia man in the Yakima Valley who said they would like to go out and hunt Indians. That's kind of how they looked at it. The Army's official role was as a peacekeeper, more of a policing force, and they preferred that. They didn't see any sense. They thought it was beneath them to go out and engage in Indian warfare. It wasn't kind of warfare they engaged in the Mexican-American War, you know, for example, with a real enemy.
It seems, you know, it was interesting to read that Steptoe, Edward Steptoe, Colonel Steptoe, was one of those who, at least at times, was, I don't want to say confused, but certainly reticent and aware that, you know, the Army was in a difficult position because of the insightful character at times of white settlers and these militias, And he shared some of his correspondence in the book to that effect. But he is assigned early in 1858 two years earlier, actually, to go set up, establish Fort Walla Walla, which is not that far from the site of the Whitman massacre, actually.
Right.
And spends two miserable winters there with with his troops. It was a force of 150 or so.
104, yeah.
And then this becomes, for reasons I'll let you explain, because I don't perfectly understand, he decides that he's going to go into the garden, this area between the Snake and the Spokane. Pick it up from there.
That's still kind of a mystery. There's been some speculation. But I think a big factor in that was that Steptoe allowed himself to be misled by a scout named Timothy, Nez Perce scout. And I think Father Josette came to this conclusion, too. Steptoe should have gone from Walla Walla to the northwest and reached the road, the Colville Road, which was the primary route for the army and white settlers. And it went through the Scablands and then went up east of Spokane out by Deep Creek and continued up to Fort Colville. And Steptoe had said he wanted to go up to Fort Colville and investigate some complaints about some conflicts and so on, some murders. Instead, he went...
Miners, as I recall.
Yeah, and instead...
Miners with an E, not...
Yeah, right. Yeah, not kids. So he, but he went northeast across a different crossing, some at least 25 miles away from where he should have been at the crossing, and then ended up heading north through present day Moscow, Idaho, that right on the Idaho's, what is now the Idaho side of the border, and then curved back into the Washington Palouse, being led by Timothy. And headed up towards what is today the Turnbull Wildlife Refuge.
I remember you talking about this.
It was an odd path.
Yeah, it was sensitive because what lay in the way, right where he was headed was...
There's a kind of a seasonal lake on the edge of the Turnbull Wildlife Refuge called Stubblefield Lake, and that was the site of a village called Sela, and that was where the women from various tribes would go in the spring to dig bulbs, prepare food, pick berries, and teach the girls how to become women, and teach them all of the traditions and so on. And as the various members of the various men of the tribe saw this army force heading up through this weird pathway, this curve, without an apparent direction, they started to think that they were coming to attack the village. In fact, one of the Coeur d'Alenes inflamed things by shouting that they're coming to get your women and children. And there was some real animosity between the Nez Perce and the Coeur d'Alenes, and Timothy's plan was to take Steptoe right into the Coeur d'Alene territory, which he did, and piss off the Coeur d'Alenes and try to get the army and the Coeur d'Alenes into a fight. So there was this, you know, there's personal dynamics going on everywhere, right? And it was the same back then. So that part didn't have really much to do with white Indian relations. That was a personal thing. But as soon as Steptoe went out and insisted that he be allowed passage through Spokane territory, then things started to go bad. And that's when Father Josette was called.
And he arrives.
He rode 90 miles in one day.
And he, according to one of the troops account, he just arrives kind of out of thin air.
Yeah.
And he's very alarmed.
Yeah.
And he's trying to ward off this.
He gets them to talk, you know, and Steptoe starts to get it, and they start to retreat. And that's when Qualchan and some other warriors attack the rear of Steptoe's force, and they fire the first shots. And then that's when the running battle started. Mm-hmm. And then that ends with Steptoe's force hunkered down on a hillside on the south end of present-day Rosalia.
Which people show is not Steptoe Butte. I mean, this is actually quite a ways from Steptoe Butte.
Yes. Yes, it is. Imagine Steptoe... I'm sure Steptoe saw Steptoe Butte, but I'm pretty sure he never was
anywhere
near.
It didn't have anything to do with the battle.
No.